This is My Daddy Station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, Eager.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a non-profit community service.
This is the voice of freedom. Listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, boy, have I got one for you tonight. I hope you're comfortable, and I hope you have pen and paper by your side, because once again, I'm going to rattle your cage with facts, quoting to you right from the mouth, from the mouth of the beast, so to speak. People keep telling me that, gee, there's no conspiracy. This all happens by accident. Sure, there's crooks in government, and you know, but none of this stuff is planned. Folks, if that were true, if it all happened by accident, I don't remember who said this, but someone said it. If it all really happened by accident, ladies and gentlemen, the law of probability would make some of it, at least once in a while, happen in our favor. Don't you think so? I want you all to have pen and paper. I want you to be comfortable, because I'm going to be expanding your mind. I'm going to take you backwards. I'm going to show you that these things are thought out well in advance, planned, orchestrated. Amongst men and women who conspire to change the world to suit their vision of a utopian brotherhood of man, a socialist paradise with no nation states, no national boundaries, no religions save one, secular humanism, the ancient pagan religions will return with the promise that Satan made to Eve in the Garden of Eden, that man himself will become God. And I tell you, right now, no man will ever become God. And that's one of the, just the fact that men sit around and think these thoughts is one of the reasons I know it can never happen. The very concept that imperfect men know what is best for other imperfect men is the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard in my life. Man can rule only when man has restraint and when man is watched, and when the watchers have the means to overcome those who rule, in case they should get a little bit too big for their britches. History tells us that that happens all too often. All too often? Gee, must be joking. It happens all the time. In fact, it's just about the only thing that's ever happened that we can count on. Give a man power and he'll want more. Try to keep him from getting more and he will scheme and conspire until he gets more. And the more he gets, the more he misuses it. The more he misuses it, the easier it becomes to do all the wrong things, for all the wrong reasons, to all the wrong people. Those who will not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Pay close attention during the next 43 or so minutes. The bell tolls for you. You'd better listen to it. Last night I managed to get a little ahead of myself, and tonight you're going to catch up with me. The Society of Rosicrucians is the incorporation of the Societas Rosicruciana in America, SRIA, the Latin name by which the Rosicrucian Society of America is sometimes, and in fact more popularly, known. The Society of Rosicrucians is a lineal descendant and, in America, the branch of the society first formulated by Christian Rosenkreutz, the esoteric pseudonym of a spiritually minded monk who was born in A.D. 1378 and died in 1484. After extensive travels, during which he gathered the fabrics of still more ancient schools, he formed his first, second, and third circles. These circles were first known to the Fratres as our Honorable Society, and later became known as the Fraternity or Fratres of the Rose or Rosy Cross. And from this beginning, ladies and gentlemen, the Rosicrucian work was introduced into England by Michael Mayer in 1620, later in 1646, developed in London by Elias Ashmole, William Lilly, Thomas and George Wharton. In 1866, the society was reorganized in England by Frater Robert Wentworth Little, assisted by Fratres Hewen, Widman, and others. The Societas Rosicruciana in the United States was formed and proclaimed in 1880, with Frater Charles E. Meyer as first Supreme Magus. This organization is confined exclusively to Masonic membership. You see, I told you on many occasions that at the highest levels, ladies and gentlemen, all of these organizations are intertwined like the hair and the braids of a young schoolgirl. At the highest level, they make up the full body of adepts known as the Illuminati, the enlightened ones, the illumined ones, the sons of God, the sons of man. Great brotherhood, the wings overshadowing the land, the society of shepherds, the Jason society. For clues to what that means, read Jason and the Golden Fleece once again. In Georgia, there is a strange monument that has been erected called the Georgia Guidestones. Mysterious monument with a vital message, they say, for humanity. And all of this that I am delivering to you tonight, ladies and gentlemen, comes directly from the Rosicrucian Digest, the official magazine of the worldwide Rosicrucian Order. Now, I have been to Georgia. I have seen the Guidestones. I have several other articles that I've been accumulating on these Guidestones because I'm fixing to write an article of my own for Veritas newspaper. While we were at Area 51, one of the people who came on the trip brought me a whole packet of photographs of the Georgia Guidestones. You see, when I saw them years ago, I had no idea. I had no idea that I was looking at something significant for the future of the human race. And so I didn't take any pictures. Didn't do anything but gawk like the other tourists and quickly became bored and left. Give me another chance. And I'll stay there and examine them and measure them and photograph them for many hours, probably. This article in the Rosicrucian Digest was written by Carl F. Hollenbach, Fraternitas Rosicrucia. On a hill in rural Georgia stand five large upright granite blocks aligned like Stonehenge with the sun and the moon. Reaching over 19 feet in height, a center slab and four corner slabs support a capstone weighing 12 tons. 4-inch high letters sandblasted on each side of the four corner slabs spell out the same message in 8 languages: English, Spanish, Russian, Chinese, Arabic, Hebrew, Swahili, and Hindi. The message on these Georgia Guidestones espouses the conservation of humanity and future generations. The guides are as follows, and this is exactly what it says on the stones. And I quote, "Maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature. Guide reproduction wisely, improving fitness and diversity. Unite humanity with a living new language. Rule passion, faith, tradition, and all things with tempered reason. Protect people and nations with fair laws and just courts. Let all nations rule internally, resolving external disputes in a world court. Avoid petty laws and useless officials. Balance personal rights with social duties. Prize truth, beauty, love, seeking harmony with the infinite. Be not a cancer on the earth. Leave room for nature. Leave room for nature," end quote. Well, folks, I did not repeat that. That's exactly the way it is on the Guidestone. Around the sides of the capstone, a different message is written in 4 dead languages: Classical Greek, Sanskrit, Babylonian cuneiform, and Egyptian hieroglyphics. The messages beseech, quote, "Let these be a guidestone to an age of reason," end quote. The mystery that shrouds the Guidestones began in June 1979 when a well-dressed and articulate man walked into the office of Joe H. Findlay, Sr., president of Elberton Granite Finishing Company. He wanted to know the cost of building a large monument to the conservation of humanity. He identified himself as Mr. Christian and told Findlay that he represented a small group of Americans who wished to remain anonymous forever. Findlay told him that his was a wholesale company which didn't handle small individual orders. Christian persisted, telling Findlay what he wanted. A monument of the size Christian described had never been attempted in Elberton, although the town, sitting atop a huge granite deposit, is the granite capital of the world. He further told Findlay that his name, Christian, was a pseudonym with only a symbolic meaning. Findlay became suspicious when Christian revealed his reasons for wanting the monument. He said he wanted a monument which he called a guidestone for the conservation of the world and to herald the coming age of reason. Now I will repeat this. To herald the coming age of reason. The group, he said, had spent the past 20 years pondering humanity's fate and considered the monument as a project going to the very heart of current and future civilizations. Should there be a Holocaust on the civilized world, the group wished the Guidestones to be one of the most enduring things to help humanity start anew. Christian inquired where Findlay banked. Skeptical, Findlay referred him to his friend and president of the Granite City Bank, Wyatt C. Martin. Identifying himself now as R.C. Christian, he selected Martin to be the intermediary for the project and the only person knowing his true identity. He told Martin that the sponsors had planned the monument for years and that the 10 guides were carefully worded as a moralistic appeal to all peoples regardless of nationality, religion, or politics. He wanted the monument erected in a remote area away from the main tourist centers. Because of the availability of excellent granite, he chose Georgia. Martin took Christian to a farm 8 miles north of Elberton on the highest point in Elbert County, which rests upon the Elberton Granite Deposit, a huge mass of granite roughly 35 miles long, 6 miles wide, and most probably 2 to 3 miles deep. They inspected the farm of contractor Wayne Mullinitz, which proved to be the ideal location. Christian chose a 5-acre plot on Mullinitz's farm with a view uninterrupted in all directions. A few weeks later, Martin contracted Joe Findlay and told him that funds for the project were in an escrow account and to start work immediately. Martin promised that when the project was completed, he would deliver his file on the affair to the anonymous sponsors and that the secret would never be known. Supervised by Findlay and guided by the strict requirements of Mr. R.C. Christian, skilled workers pulled blocks of high-quality granite, a rough, tough, durable rock, one-third as heavy as steel, but 2 to 3 times as heavy as concrete. Blocks for building purposes are normally 18 to 20 tons. The Guidestones were 10 tons heavier. The 91 words were translated into 7 languages besides English and sandblasted on the sides of the great slabs. And in March 1980, the project was finished. Christian said he was impressed by Stonehenge in England and wanted the monument in Elbert County to be astronomically aligned. The stones are placed so that certain holes and slits do align astronomically with the North Celestial Pole, the noonday sun, the rising and setting points of the sun and moon on the horizon. A slit at eye level in the central upright slab permits an observer to view the eastern and western horizons, where the sun and moon rise and set. A 2-inch diameter hole through the center stone from south to north is inclined at an angle of 34 degrees and points to the celestial north pole. The North Star can be seen through this hole at night. A beam of sunlight passing through a hole in the capstone forms a spot of light below. The position of the spot can be used to determine high noon and today's date on any day. A granite slab near the guidestones states that a time capsule was placed 6 feet below on blank to be opened on blank, adding to the mystery as both dates are missing. 1 year after completion of the project, the final correspondence arrived in Elberton from R.C. Christian and the group responsible for the guidestones. It concludes with, quote, "The first step will be to convince a doubting world that such a society is now possible. We must order our home here on Earth before we can reach for the stars," end quote. The pseudonym R.C. Christian suggests a reference to the Fama Fraternitas, to the will and meaning of Father Christian Rosenkreutz, or to Christian Rosenkreutz. The mystery, however, of who is behind the building of the Georgia Guidestones is intended to be a secret forever. Good luck, we know that it was the Fraternitas Rosacruci who erected this thing. And it was not an accident, ladies and gentlemen, that it was built, ladies and gentlemen, on the farm of Wayne Mullinix, who is also a member of the Fraternitas Rosacruci. Now, that's just the beginning. For I have digest after digest of the Fraternitas Rosacruci, which I've been collecting for many years. And many people who belong to our organizations are constantly searching these out and sending me copies. So we have sometimes 2, 3, and 4 copies of one issue. Sometimes we don't have any copies of certain issues. And sometimes we only have one copy of most of the issues that we have. But we are very happy to have them. And if you find any of these things lying around anywhere, we don't care what the date of them is, we would appreciate it if you would send them to us. Did you know, ladies and gentlemen, that the European Union is not new? Not new at all. Because I am holding here, in my hand, the April, May, June issue of the La Rose and Croix of 1929, calling for the United States of Europe. It is not the first time that a United States of Europe was called for or planned, but this was the very first completely spelled out, and I mean spelled out, method of bringing it about. And, of course, now you see it is happening. But it's an accident, folks. It just, you know, came about just a few years ago. It couldn't possibly have been planned as early as 1929 or before that, but, of course, it was. And you don't have to believe me. In fact, I prefer that you don't, as you well know. So I'm going to read to you something else from Rosicrucian Digest, number 2, 1995, volume 73, number 2. This summer marks two important anniversaries of events that occurred a half century ago. The end of the most devastating war in human history, World War II, and the founding of the United Nations in San Francisco. And that long-ago summer of 1945, as the Second World War came to a close, vast stretches of Europe and Asia lay in ruin. 6 years of war and incessant bombing had laid waste major cities and thousands of acres of once productive farmland. Millions of people were dead. Millions more were hungry and homeless. Even as the Allied nations achieved victory that summer, there was a palpable sense of numbness, dislocation, and hopelessness worldwide. Describing the aftermath of that terrible war, Rosicrucian Imperator Ralph M. Lewis later wrote, quote, "The race now was against time, the winner or loser to be humanity at large. Atheism, anarchy, and despair were competing with moral idealism and humanitarianism for the enlistment of the multitude. By the former, humanity could only experience annihilation. By the latter, that refinement which we call true civilization could be attained." Now remember, they speak in symbology, ladies and gentlemen. When they talk about atheism, anarchy, and despair as adverse to moral idealism and humanitarianism, they're not talking about religion as you know it. They're not talking about Christianity. They're not talking about Buddhism. They're not talking about Judaism. They're not talking about the Catholic Church. In the closing months of the war, a major international conference, the World Security Conference, was held in San Francisco, California, with the purpose of bringing about cooperation between peoples and nations in the post-war era. This conference soon led to the formation of the United Nations. Those of you who lived through those days, ladies and gentlemen, might remember that all through the Second World War, the Allied forces were called the United Nations in newspapers, on radio, on television, in headlines, preparing the world for the formation of the United Nations, built upon what they had learned from the League of Nations, which, of course, did not work. On April 25, 1945, the conference's opening day, 282 delegates from around the world, including a number of Rosicrucians, convened to begin laying the foundations for enduring peace, economic stability, and the rights and expectations of the world's peoples. Imperator Ralph M. Lewis, personally aware of the wartime plight of thousands of Rosicrucians worldwide, and feeling that humanity was at a crucial crossroads, took an active role in the conference and its goals. His eyewitness account of the opening session follows this preface. Among Rosicrucians attending as official representatives of their nations or as delegates and from humanitarian organizations were Frater J.A. Calcaño, Chief Counsel of the Venezuelan Delegation and AMORC Grand Counselor for Venezuela, Soror Isabel Sanchez de Urdaneta, and Dr. Carlos Rodriguez Jimenez, Secretary of the Venezuelan Delegation, Soror Clemencia Ostos de Gil, Chairperson of the People's Mandate Committee of Mexico and representative of the University Women of Mexico, and Frater William V. Whittington of the United States State Department, Technical Advisor on Treaties to the Conference Secretariat, and AMORC Grand Counselor for Washington, D.C. On June 26, 1945, delegates of 50 nations signed the United Nations Charter in San Francisco. In the 5 decades since its birth, the United Nations has served the global community, touching every aspect of life around the world. Rosicrucians can be proud that they were involved in founding this humanitarian organization. Thus, it is to the ideal of peace among nations and the historic role Rosicrucians have played in achieving peace that we dedicate this issue of the Rosicrucian Digest, signed Robin M. Thompson, FRC editor. And they go on to describe the conference. Now remember, they're always talking about how they do it for the children. Remember when they burned the children and the men and women in Waco, Texas, they said that they did it for the children? Do you remember that, ladies and gentlemen? Listen to this. The smiling faces of these girls suggested a zest for life, a confidence in the future that will rise above the possible intrigues of their elders. The conference might well be termed a success if tomorrow's children throughout the world would have occasion as the result of its deliberations to so easily and freely smile. You see, even back then, they were doing it for the children. I'm just going to go through parts of this because I have so much to cover. The grand plan. Listen to this. This article is called Fate of the World by Ralph M. Lewis, Fraternitas Rosicrucis. Reprinted from the Rosicrucian Digest, June 1945. Realism had long been known. It had often stripped men of their fancies and aspirations and caused them to stand exposed, naked in the necessities of life. However, it was now a realism that was conscious of the need to regulate itself. The end could no longer justify the means. No society could live entirely to itself. The weight of those whom it might destroy by exploitation would press in upon it, pulling everything down. opposed to this realism was a utopian idealism based on the self-worth of every individual human being. And this idealism was now conceived as virtuous by all who are conscious of the golden mean between deficient and excessive acts. This idealism conceives a world where people are expected to gladly give to their neighbors without asking in return for power, fame, and superior wealth. This idealism overlooks the instinctive urges of men and their foibles, although it sees in the petty circles of human affairs how millions lie, cheat, and destroy each other's livelihood without an attempt at personal discipline. Yet this idealism asks for a social order wherein such conduct would be outlawed by words. If either traditional realism or extreme idealism are to be victorious, what can the world expect? Hope seems to lie alone in a compromise. What this compromise might be, no one dare offer a prediction. And I'm skipping a little. These, we can surmise, might have been conscious of the drama that was to be enacted with and listened. And I'm skipping a couple of pages now. The grand plan. Remember, folks, I told you there was always a plan, the great work, the grand plan. The grand plan. The acceptance of the Dumbarton Oaks proposals in general must be made to supersede and appeal the personal and limited interests of all such groups. Just as in each sovereign state, the interests of the individual must be subordinated to the common good, so the interests of these groups must needs be subordinated to the purpose of world peace. It was impossible to excoriate from one's thinking the negative thought that possibly some of these groups, buzzing to themselves, might have a selfish hope that a world state could be used to promote their ends against others. This was brought to my mind by an article appearing in a recent religious magazine. The Rosicrucian Order had reason to protest to the officials of a religious sect on their misinterpretation of the order in their literature. In an answer in their magazine to our protest, they concluded that we were anti-Christian, notwithstanding the large number of our members who are Christians. Most dangerous, however, was their implied hope expressed in the last paragraph of their article, which said, quote, "There are numerous anti-Christian cults employing the same method. Until the Constitution of the United States is revised, we believe we have the right to caution Christian people against such snares," end quote. Was this to mean that they hoped that the Constitution would be revised so that religious freedom would no longer exist, and they would not have competition, that the freedom of difference of thought would be, in the future, be extirpated by constitutional provision? Could I ask myself any of these groups present beholding such thoughts? Now let me explain to you first, ladies and gentlemen, the society Fraternitas Rosicrucis is anti-Christian, as anti-Christian as you could possibly imagine. And there are some religious groups that call themselves Christians who would do exactly what he feared. I oppose both. I am for the freedom of all people, liberty and freedom with responsible of every single human being upon the face of this earth. And I oppose anyone who would work their will on others if those others are not injuring the person or property of any other human being. I continue, skipping one paragraph. The tenseness of excitement was evidenced by one incident. Band music burst forth from the huge public address speakers. People immediately rose to their feet, imagining that the first number would be the national anthem. When it proved to be but a march, they looked sheepishly at each other, realizing their quickened emotions had influenced their imagination, and they became seated again. And I'm skipping a little bit further. No one could or did enter without special credentials. The general public was not admitted unless they were representatives of recognized organizations registered with the Department of State for the occasion. And skipping ahead some more. They represented what this conference must prevent in the future. To fail may mean the end of civilization. Immediately following these and entering from the right and in the following order were the Honorable Edward All, R. Stettinius, Jr., Secretary of State, followed by the Honorable Earl Warren, Governor of California, the Honorable Roger P. Lapham, Mayor of San Francisco, and Mr. Alger Hiss, Secretary General of the conference. Alger Hiss later turned out to be a highly degreed member of the Illuminati and a member of the Communist Party, was eventually found out and imprisoned for his espionage against the United States of America. If you lay the United Nations Charter down next to the old Constitution of the Soviet Union, they are almost exactly identical. And I ask that you don't believe me. I ask that you make the test. Both are readily obtainable by anybody who wishes to obtain them. The audience unanimously responded by various reactions to the words of the president when he said, quote, "In your hands rests our future," end quote. Then again when he uttered, quote, "Make another war impossible, nothing is more important than peace of the world and cooperation among nations," end quote. During the president's address, Mr. Stettinius reached forward several times and took from the lectern a glass of water which he sipped. Twice also he patted his cheek and mouth with his handkerchief. This is from the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle, April 25, 1945. On the opening day of the World Security Conference, as World War II was drawing to a close in Europe, San Francisco's newspapers reflected, commented on, and reported in depth the great excitement, tension, and momentousness surrounding the conference. In a headline article of the San Francisco Chronicle's front page, journalist Stanton Delaplane captured the mood. Quote, "The curtain rises today in San Francisco in a crucial act of the greatest drama of our time. With the sound effects echoing rape and blood and machine gun fire, a charter for the world will be drafted by men and women of 46 nations. In the dining rooms and hotel rooms and fireplaces of San Francisco today, the structure of our world is being formed for tomorrow," end quote. The newspaper's front page editorial entitled, quote, "The Meaning of Today," end quote, had the following observations, and I quote, "There is something essentially mystic about the tide in the affairs of men which has been running now for upward of 10 years. We know it flows intensified from the old tension which made the 1914 war, but we can't quite fathom its true character. So we have arrived at one of those junctures of the crises where we can catch our breath. The enemies of the civilized order are near the end of their rope. We see a little daylight where perhaps some of the immense problems besetting us may be talked down, where perhaps some of the immense forces battering us may be harnessed. We believe we may be able, with God's help, to establish some kind of association of men, a framework within which they can attack and in some measure cool off the fiery forces and the smoldering maladjustments which threaten to consume us. The association itself, if established, cannot make a stable world. Only men using association as a foundation can make a stable world. The chance is there." And I skip ahead again now, back to the Fate of the World article. "It was with a sense of pride that I attended this first plenary session of the World Security Conference as a representative of the Rosicrucian Order, AMORC. See, the public was not invited, but he was an official representative of the Rosicrucian Order. I also had great pride and knowledge of the fact that in attendance at all of these important sessions would be 6 Rosicrucians who are official members of delegations representing their respective nations. Each of these individuals are experts in affairs of government. I knew that insofar as it was in their power, they would exercise their talents and the tolerant liberal principles of Rosicrucianism in all of their deliberations and duties. In fact, just 3 days before attending this conference, I had conferred with 2 such Rosicrucian delegates, and this morning I had walked with 1 such official and member of AMORC from his temporary office established in San Francisco to the conference auditorium. These representatives are very conscious that in their hands and in those of all their associates rests our future. They are truly motivated by the cosmic impulse to make another war impossible." Now, ladies and gentlemen, there are hundreds of fraternal orders, all harboring at the top of their pyramids of initiation those known as the Illuminati, the Brotherhood, the Order, if you will, who intend to bring about their version of what the world should be, regardless of what anyone else thinks. And remember, folks, I've been telling you for many years that one of their goals is to reduce the world's population. Reduce the world population. And their official number is 500 million. There are close to 6 billion people on the world right now. And that should tell you a little bit about the benevolence of their plan. Are you going to be the one eliminated? I would venture to say that probably every single person listening to this broadcast tonight, if these people have their way, will be eliminated, killed, murdered, destroyed in the name of the world utopian social order. Are you happy with that? Did you hear all the buzzwords in there? You really believe that they are thinking the best thoughts for the human race? No, not at all. They're thinking only of themselves, their order. Guess who will be spared? The sum total membership of these fraternal bodies. Of course, those at the highest levels of initiation will be spared first. And if there are not enough of them to make up the 500 million upon the face of this earth, then the lower degreed brothers will be spared. And sisters, did you hear all of the buzzwords that denote socialism? Did you hear the phrases self-sacrifice, freely give to others without any reward? Do everything for the betterment of the social order. The government must overweigh the rights of the individual for the good of the whole. These are all socialist, Marxist, communist phrases, which for some reason seem to just bounce right over the heads of most people who just don't catch on. Here's an article from the New Age, January 1908, A Master of the Magi, by Mysticus. Magic is the traditional science of the secrets of nature which comes to us from the Magi. A quote from Eliphas Levi. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is the official magazine of the southern jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. They teach magic. They teach magic. Here are pictures of instruments used in magic incantations: the lamp, sword, wand, and pruning hook. The central doctrine of magic may be summed up thus: that an intangible and real cosmic medium exists which interpenetrates, influences, and supports the tangible and apparent world. B, that there is an established analogy and equilibrium between this unseen world and the illusory manifestations which we call the world of sense. C, that this analogy may be discerned and this equilibrium controlled by the disciplined will of man, which thus becomes master of itself and to a certain degree director of its fate. Takes up most of the magazine. It's a big article. Here's another one, February 1908. Quote, the connection between Rosicrucianism and Freemasonry has been the subject of much discussion. Robert Craik Gould, in his Condensed History of Freemasonry, page 127, asks, were the Brethren of the Rosy Cross or their immediate precursors, the Hermetic philosophers, the last link in an invisible chain connecting early Freemasonry with some of the now almost forgotten learning of antiquity. Many of our foremost students of the craft were and are of opinion that this question admits of an affirmative reply, end quote. The official magazine of the southern jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. A Freemason cannot ever be a Christian. Now, I'm not telling you that you have to be a Christian. I'm not telling you that you have to be a Freemason. I'm not telling you that it's wrong to be a Freemason or wrong to be a Christian or anything else. I believe in freedom. What's wrong is when these people get together and decide my future for me without asking me. That's what's wrong. They meet in secret. They teach mysteries. They have secret handshakes, signs, and words. They are sworn, upon pain of death, the most horrible death you can imagine, never to divulge the secrets of the craft. So when you come and tell me, my grandfather was a Freemason, and he told me there's nothing to all of this. Let me say this again, you dolt. He is sworn, upon pain of death, never to reveal the secrets of the craft. Do you understand that? I don't care if he's your husband, your brother, your grandfather, your father, your uncle, your aunt, or your mother. They are sworn to carry out the great work. They're no more Christian than this glass of water I'm holding in my hand is Christian. And some Christians are no more Christian than this glass of water I'm holding in my hand also. And that goes for Catholics and Buddhists and everybody else. Most people are stumbling around in this world, ricocheting off of trees because they don't know beans about anything. They think they do. They think they're the great experts. They think like I did when I was 16. I thought I knew it all. That's really strange, you know. It's backwards. Because now I know that there's very little that I know, but I know that I know more than most of you that are listening. In this issue of the New Age, on page 268, there's an article called The Master of the Veils. Talk about a funeral at midnight. A ponderous bell in the church steeple slowly struck 12. In the large auditorium of the sacred edifice, a crowd of people had assembled to witness the last obsequies of a titan. The angel of death brooded over the scene with shadowy wings. In the center of the room stood a catafalque draped in black, and resting upon it was a casket containing the mortal remains of a great soul, arranged in triangles about the east, west, and south sides of the catafalque, were burning tapers and tall candlesticks of silver. A huge iron cross was set at the head of this catafalque. Nearby stood a table covered with black velvet, upon which were 7 large candlesticks, but without the lights, a silver cup filled with salt, and a skull crowned with a laurel wreath. The gloom of the apartment was intensified by being hung with black cloth. The lights of the wax tapers illumined the face of the dead man, likewise the mocking skull wreathed with laurel, and brought into bold relief the iron cross. At the last stroke of the bell, an organ softly played a miserere, and there marched into the room from out of the Egyptian darkness a long file of men in somber uniforms, bearing lighted candles in their hands. They took their places about the catafalque, the venerable master at the head near the Passion Cross. A trumpet sounded in the distance, and the services began. The venerable master struck with a sledge 3 times upon the iron cross,
and challenged anyone to present a charge against the dead man. There was no response, and the trial ended with the declaration that not man, but God only is capable of judging the dead. Upon the remains were a chaplet of laurel, vines, and berries, representing living joy, a glittering cross representing glory and splendor, and a bunch of violets as a token of grief. All but the violets were removed, as it was declared the dead knight had passed beyond and above earthly pleasures, vainglory, and sorrows. The cords about the hands of the adept were untied, and those about the feet, symbolical of the release of the soul from the enslavement of the body. After a number of other significant offices were performed, the knights, spelled K-N-I-G-H-T-S, all knelt. The venerable master invoked the blessing upon the dead. The lights were extinguished one by one as the knights withdrew silently from the apartment. All Scottish Rite Masons will recognize in this description the funeral services of the 30th degree, the night of Kadash, which for weirdness and impressiveness is unsurpassed. The splendid degree of the Kadash portrays the trials and sufferings of Jacques de Molay, the Grand Master of the Knights Templars, who fell a victim to the machination of Philippe de Bel of France and Pope Clement V. De Molay and his fellows perished in the flames of the Inquisition. You think if they were Christian, they would be beating upon a cross with a sledgehammer? Do you, ladies and gentlemen? And what did they say about the cross? A glittering cross representing glory and splendor, and a bunch of violence as a token of grief. But if you ask them, they'll tell you that it's Christian order. It's not. It is a lie. They're sworn to revenge the death of Jacques de Molay and their fellow Knights Templar by the destruction of the church, ladies and gentlemen, the destruction of all nation states, and the shackling of the mob. It was the state and the church that destroyed their order, that burned Jacques de Molay and many other of the high-ranked members of the Knights Templar in France. It was the Pope and the King of France. From that date, they set out to destroy all nation states, all kings and queens, and all existing religions, especially the Christian religion, and to shackle the mob which stood and jeered and yelled when the flames burned their fellow members of their fraternity. And I could go on and on and on. As I have done in the past, hours and hours and hours of documentation, and I love to do it in their own words, because they can never refute their own words. It is absolutely impossible to do. And even when they speak in the symbolic language that they are noted for, I know that language and can interpret for you and have steered you to those tomes, also written in their own language, which explain the symbology so that you too can learn the language. You see, the universal language is the language of symbology, ladies and gentlemen. Remember before, on the guide stones, what did it say? Do you remember? What did it say, folks? It said to create a universal language. Do you remember that? Let me read it to you again. Well, they've already done it. They did it many hundreds and maybe thousands of years ago. Unite humanity with a living new language. It is the language of symbology. Always has been. You thought they were going to create a new language and ask everybody on the face of this earth to learn it, to discard their native language and learn a new one, and the whole world was going to converse in this new language? Not on your life, folks. The language has always been there. They invented it and have been using it for thousands of years. They call it the universal language understood by the subconscious of all men and women. And well, it may be. I don't know. You understand it? I do. Some others do who are outside of this fraternal orders, but not many of us, I can guarantee you. and they certainly don't like it that we do. That much is certain. We'll continue this tomorrow night because I have a lot more to go, and maybe we'll even go into the storage locker and dig out the boxes of ancient tomes and artifacts and issues of the New Age and the Rosicrucian Digest and many others, some from old England. Maybe we can resurrect some of the writings of the ancient Templars themselves. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. And remember, this is not a religious broadcast. I am not disparaging Freemasons because they're not Christians. I am disparaging them because they are liars. God bless each and every single one of you. It's about time you all woke up, ladies and gentlemen. You've been looking around for the enemy. Who is destroying this country? You're always looking without. Or you're always looking through accidental circumstances to explain it away. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to know what's wrong with this country, go in your bathroom and look in the mirror. You'll find the problem staring you in the face. If you want to know who the enemy is that's destroying this country, think of this. There isn't an army or a group of armies on the face of this earth that can deliver their military might to these shores and conquer this nation. It must be done from within. The enemy is your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your grandmother, your sister, who belong to the fraternal orders, which harbor the hearts and soul of socialism and the Illuminati. They are destroying this country from within. And it's not just one, it's all of them. At the lower levels, you have a bunch of fools that have joined an organization. They were told when they joined, they would never be told what they were joining until they were initiated. And then, and only then, could they be told because they were under oath, and then they're only told very little. They have to prove their trustworthiness and their abilities. And only then are they progressed up the pyramidal ladder of degrees. Only the most trusted and the most devoted to the great work and the great plan and the hidden mystery religion of ancient Babylon ever reached the top. These men occupy the highest levels in our military, our government, both state and federal, city and county. And you had better discover them, and you had better root them out. You had better be able to identify the enemies of this republic. They are about treason. They are consciously and methodologically setting about to destroy freedom, to bring about a socialist, totalitarian, new world, utopian state. And it will be upon the ashes of this great nation, I can assure you. There will be no constitution and there will be no individual rights. You're listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network.